session number 10295, reel 6.
Mr. Lane, reel 6.
Yeah, the planes then just had to follow these arrows coming in. Other things were, other methods that they used was to fire into the backs of troops. Any emplacement, machine gun emplacements, anything like that. They used to spend time just firing at it. We'd no time to do anything about it because you're watching what's coming towards you. You're not watching what's coming behind you. You're hoping that the people behind are looking after your back. But to give you a particular instance, so it was just near the end of the war, actually. We had a machine gun post set up, and there's, as usual, there's four men on the gun. Number one, two, three, and four. And he got one or two hangers on the driver, or a bloke going fetching tea, or whatever. And on this particular instance, one of the drivers, Nobby Clark, he pointed out to me that over on the left-hand side from where we were, there were some placards, and they were advertising Goodyear tyres. And they were the same placards then as they are now, bloody great things, you know. And the base of it was about 3 foot, 2 foot off the floor. And Nobby Clark had seen somebody underneath it. He'd seen the legs of somebody moving behind it. So we let off a couple of shots into that direction. You know, we hadn't got time really to do it, but we let off a couple of shots. And then went back to facing the area they were covering. And they came creeping over again. Nobby said, "He's there again, he's there again." So I said, "How do you know it's a he?" He said, "Well, whoever it is, there's somebody there." So, of course, we whispered them between us and said, "Right, four of us, turn round and let's put a volley into it and have done with it once and for all." So we turned round and we all fired. And we really blasted this poster, this advert. And that was it. We forgot about it. The legs went. We didn't even bother to go and see if we'd killed anybody. We left it. The culmination is that in 1979, I went back to Singapore and I put an advert in the paper saying that if anybody knew me or if anybody knew my regiment, I'd be prepared to meet them and have a drink and discuss old times. And there were several people came up. There was a Chinese woman that I met and one or two more. And one man came to me and he asked me, was I one of those who had been in the machine gun post on the Geylang Road? So I said, yes, I can remember it very well, because everybody knew us, you know, we were machine gunners. He said, could you tell me who was actually on the Geylang Road, you know, just before the war ended? And he mentioned the date, so I said, yes, I was. He said, well, can you tell me who were the soldiers that shot at me? So I said, shot at you? He said, yeah. He said, I was 11... He said, yeah, I was 11 years of age at the time. He said, I was curious. I'd never seen people fighting before. I'd heard all the bombs and everything, but I'd never seen anybody fighting. And he was curious, and he was peeping through the slits in the placard and watching the machine gunners to see what they were going to do and when the war started. You know. And we'd been shooting at an 11-year-old boy.
Was he hit?
No. He was too small. We'd fired above his head. We'd fired at a man. He was a little lad, little Chinese. But anyway...
Did he laugh about it?
Yes, yeah. He gave me a lot of photographs. I still write to him today.
Going back to the 5th Columnists, did you actually witness these 5th Column incidents yourself? Like the putting the petrol in the... sugar in the petrol and stuff?
Oh, you never saw that, because, you know, they did that when nobody was around.
You saw it afterwards?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, we've got vehicles that wouldn't move. You know, we went out and you'd see the signs in the trees, you know, the leaves that were spread out. I most certainly felt heard the bullets whistling over the top, coming from behind. There was no Japanese behind us. But the cause of that, actually, was we was, as I say, down at the school and waiting for another call out. My section, they called us, what was it called? 16 Platoon, I think it was called. And we was composed of odd soldiers and drummers and bandsmen. any oddbods to form sections, machine gun sections. We'd been trained. We'd been training for 3 years. But the band were all trained as first aid men. They were non-combatants in a war. So our job was, if ever there was a breakthrough, if anybody wanted relieving, anything at all, we had to shoot out and get on with it. We had our own individual trucks, individual guns. You know, we knew everything. We knew each other individually. We'd lived, slept, worked together for 3 years. So this particular morning, after we'd rescued these lads from the bomb damage, the 5th Columnists had put the Japanese onto one of our gun positions, and the Japanese had come down and attacked the position, and we lost Major Douglas. Two more officers, I forget who they were now. And there was 2 men killed and about 7 wounded when they came back in, which left a gap in that particular area, in the Pearl Harbor. So we had the Pearl Harbor area of Singapore.
How do you spell it?
Paya, P-A-Y-A, and L-E-B-A-H, Pearl Harbor. It's a tourist area now. It's a spot where Singapore civilization finished and the jungle started. That is, if you can call it jungle in Singapore. It was, you know, rough country, trees, bamboo trees, and rubber trees. Between civilization and these trees was an expanse of about 200-300 yards of no man's land. It was wide open ground. There's nowhere we could go across it, nowhere the Jap had come across it without being spotted. So we'd gone out there and we had to erect our machine gun position in a monsoon drain. And it was a very good position, really. I'd got my machine gun on the northwest corner in a monsoon drain with the houses behind me and the house opposite. And then there's a street. Over on the northeast side was Sir Bob Anderson with his machine gun. And he was facing at the main Singapore Changi Road. Giving him cover at the back, facing the other way, was Harry Higgins with his gun. And immediately behind me was Jack Butterworth with his gun, giving me covering fire. So we're in more or less a square block. So nothing could come at us. The only way they get at us is bombing us. Now, opposite to me was, a wooden hut. And as soon as we'd set the gun up, got ourselves lined up, you know, picked up different spots and measured them out, we sat down then and waited. And the driver went, took his truck away to go and bring a cup of tea. And while he was doing that, this Chinese chappie came over and he got a little girl with him. And would we like a cup of tea? And this is in the middle of a war, you know, bombs and everything's going on. So I said, wouldn't say no. So I said, what are you doing here anyway? You know, most people have pulled back. So he said, oh no. He said, I've lived here all my life. I wish to stay here. So I said, well, where's the wife? He said, oh, she's fortunate. She's gone to England. And she'd left some months previous, you know. He said, I don't know what's the best thing to do. Should I stay or go back into Singapore? So I said, well, the best thing to do, same as everybody else, get back into Singapore. Leave the fighting, get over there, and then you can't be touched. So they went and brought our cups of tea. China cups, beautiful, you know, and some Chinese cakes and things. So we had our tea and took it back to him. This is 5 o'clock, half past five in the afternoon. And when it goes dark in Singapore, as you know, in the Far East, it goes dark suddenly. Around about 7 o'clock, and everything's switched on, and it goes dark. So he'd gone back into the house with his little girl. She would be about 9 or 10, I would imagine. And it was peculiar in that it was a wooden house, but it was a two-story structure. Most of the other two-story stuff is in bricks and mortar, you know. But anyway, we'd told him to bugger off out. And at the side of his house was the road leading through from Pearl Harbor straight into all the jungle, but met the Singapore Changi Road at the far corner. And running along this side was the various shops, post office, etc. And just before it went dark, a major in the Indian Army came running down. He was bloody hysterical. They're coming in hundreds, fire, fire, you know, and he was giving all this bull. And of course, one of the lad who was sat on the gun at the time got a bit jerky, and he was just, you know, going to set one off, let one go. And we all shouted together, you know, hold it, leave it. So this major was still blubbering and shouting. Of course, we've got no authority to tell him what to do. All we can do is ignore what he's saying. And I want your CO, I've told you what to do, you know, so we told him to go down there to the driver. So as he buggered off, we're still waiting. And I looked up to where Anderson was, my mate, which was the main road. And we'd been told that the Japanese didn't wear uniforms, not all the time. Sometimes they came down dressed as footballers, anything, postmen, you know, they'd dress up in anything. And as I looked up the road, there was a cart coming down with all straw hay on it. And it was being pulled by two blokes on bikes, two Malays on bikes, as we thought. And I don't know why, but I just decided they were Japanese. And I went down on one day and pulled them both down, killed them both up. And as they fell, I was watching in amazement, because as I was pedalling, one of them that I'd shot, he fell over on his back, and his legs were pedalling like buggery, you know. And they were Japanese, actually. And in the car was another couple more, which Andy bagged them.
But, what did you know they were Japanese, though?
Well, we didn't. We just took a chance, you know. Who would want to come down the road dragging a hay cart, you know, with a war on, the Japanese are coming this way and the British are there. You wouldn't come across, you know, dragging a hay cart, dragging your family belongings, maybe, and you'd be running. You wouldn't be riding a bloody bike. If you was riding a bike, you'd be riding without anything, you'd be going mad, you know. So I pulled two of them, as I say, and then as the cart fell, the other two fell out, and Andy saw them off. But that was only a side, you know, part of the story, was that this major had got my team really agitated. And we could still hear him in the background carrying on and shouting and screaming. And just then, just before it went dark, the Indians came down, several Indians. And there was Gurkhas, Punjabs, one thing and all. And it was nothing to see a Gurkha coming along with a bloke on his shoulder. And they'd be carrying the bloke and eating a sandwich at the same time. You know, okay, Sab, you know, and he's through and going past. But anyway, that we suspected were not Indians or not on our side. Then we either clobbered them there and then or shot them. You know, you couldn't take a chance. So I would imagine one or two Indians died. But anyway, dark suddenly came. It was black. And this Indian major is still bloody going on, crying on and shouting and shouting. And then it was suddenly just a bit of a lull. And then all of a sudden, a Jap started opening up from the western side. And I don't know what it was. Somebody shouted out fire. And the lad on the machine gun started firing. Well, any good machine gunner knows you don't fire in a one straight burst. You fire five, 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 five. Otherwise, all you're doing is spraying everything around. If you fire five at a time, they're going more or less where you want them to go. But if you just keep your finger on it, the vibration of the gun, up and down and sideways, you're just spreading a bloody big circle of bullets all around the place. So by the time I got to the gun and shouted, the bloody hell are you firing at? He'd gone through practically a full belt. So played hell with him. But what can you do? It's a war, he's jittery, he's, you know.
It's what?
It's a war, and he's a jittery man. You know, best of times. So we stopped him firing anyway. Well, two of us, myself and a fellow called Macmillan, he was from Liverpool. Mac and I went out up the road to see if we could see anything. And after going about, 100 yards or maybe more, we came across a Chinese and a Malay, both dead, both been riding bikes. They were definitely, you know, Malay and Chinese. There was no doing about them, but with nothing else, there was no, you know, attack coming at us or anything like that. I mean, we was there walking. So we came back, and we'd always been taught, never go up. If you're going out, don't come back the same way, you know, even your own men will let you have it. So we detoured and went round the back of the wooden house, and Mac said, I wonder how the old fella is, you know, the teacher. So back door was open, we went in and shouted. There's nothing, you know, couldn't hear anything. And we made towards the front door, and it was wooden huts in those days out there. The wood doesn't join, you've got cracks and, you know, crevices all over the bloody place. And we could just see bits of light, and at the front door, behind it was the what they call it, a school teacher and his daughter, and they were both dead. And Mac went back, he run back, and he brought a torch, you know, these little Woolworths torch, one of those, because the army couldn't afford to give us any decent ones. And he brought that and shone it, and they were both dead, dead as a bloody doornail. So we came out of there, and it didn't affect me. It was another casualty of war, and I assumed that Mac was the same. It hadn't affected him in the same way. And we came out, and I went towards Andy's gun post, originally with the intention of going having a natter with him, and then deciding, once I got in the monsoon drain, no, something might happen, go back to my own gun. So as I got in the monsoon drain to run back towards my own gun, there was a single shot rang out, and it was a 38. You know, you get to where you can tell the difference between the different velocity bullets. And this was definitely a 38. It was too weak to be anything else. And I run down to the gun post, and there's commotion going on. What's happened? What's going on? You know. And the lad who was on the gun, on the post, I've forgotten his name. But he was laughing his bloody side, so he said, somebody just shot the Major. So I said, you what? He said, somebody just shot the Major. And I went down, the Major's groaning and moaning on the floor, and somebody shot him in the leg. And I never saw Mac again after. I think Mac did it. But I never saw him again after. You know, everything happened so fast.
What do you think the reason might have been?
I think Mac had got his temper up and blamed him for the Chinese kid and his father being killed. And he was that type of lad. He was not sneaky, but he'd do things quietly, efficiently, quietly, and take no further part in it, you know. The type of man that you'd see, he could easily slit somebody's throat and just walk away and not bother. It wouldn't affect him. And I think what had happened, he'd blown his top and thought, this fella's responsible for them too, you know, so I'm going to get him. But his aim was wrong, and he hit him in the leg. And that was the last we saw of the Major. But Mac, as I say, I didn't see him after that. Even in the prison camps. He died two or three years later up in the North Thailand. So the culmination was from there that the machine gun having opened up through some mistake or other had drawn the attention of the Japanese. So they then concentrated with the 2-inch mortars, and they're the most vile, the wickedest ammunition or wickedest thing that could be used in the war, 2-inch mortars. They're terrible. Well, you know, yourself, the side on 2-inch, you can fling them across at anybody. And they were absolutely clever, the Japanese. Nearly every soldier was trained to use a 2-inch mortar. They didn't need a base plate. It was similar to our mortars, with the exception that instead of a base plate, it had a U-piece on the bottom. So a Japanese just knelt down on one knee, put the U-piece across the lap, or, you know, across his thigh, and from there, he judged where he was going to drop his shot. And they were absolutely marvellous. They were spot on with these things. Of course, as soon as the machine gun had given our position, then they started. And I would think there's 1 in 5 Japanese carries a mortar. And when they come, you know they're coming. It's the sound is weird. It's a swishing and a crackling. And in majority of cases, it would hit the roof, the slate roof, and either explode or come rattling down the roof and explode on the ground at the back of you. One of our lads, Lance Corporal Martin McGlynn. As soon as these things, that mortar started coming over, Martin was in a rear position behind us at the New World. And he took a 2-inch mortar straight in his chest. The whole of the mortar went in his chest and blasted. And he still bloody lived. He still asked for a cigarette. And then they buried him at the side of what we call the Kallang Bridge. He's down as one of the missing, you know, believed killed, but we know he was dead. We buried him at the side of the Kallang Bridge. But as I say, this Japanese then started lobbing these mortars over. And orders then came for us to pull back. And as soon as we started to dismount the equipment to pull back, another order came through. Don't believe any orders telling you to dismount because it's a load of pith column. Anybody comes to tell you to, you know, pull away, shoot them. So I put the gun back up again. And within the hour, dispatch rider comes down. We know he's one of ours. We know the man. He comes down. It's all over. Pull back. So it's a bit, you know, we've been told to shoot anyone that tells us to pull back. Well, I'm telling you, it's all over. Pull back. And all of a sudden, it has gone quiet. You know, it has suddenly gone very quiet. And this was on the Saturday. It's Friday or Saturday. It was 13th, I think, Friday. Was, yeah, Friday the 13th, our unlucky day. So we said, what we'll do, we'll leave the gun where it is. And one man go down and find out what the hell's going on. Because the dispatch rider is going on to various positions, locations. So we sent a runner back. And he comes back to say that we're negotiating to make Singapore into a free city. So, you know, to me, what the hell's a free city? And the bloke hadn't got the story right. He just got the and, you know, what the hell are you talking about? He didn't know. He'd been told he was going to make Singapore a free city. So we had to hold tight. So we held tight then until next morning. And then it started again. The mortars started coming over. But there had been a hell of a lull. So I think something must have been going on. You know. And then, as I say, the next morning, the mortars started again. And they started giving us a real bloody hellfire. And with no orders to pull back, you know, as far as we were concerned, Singapore was going to be a free city, which meant that we had to stay where we were. And that continued till 4 o'clock, 4:30 in the afternoon. And then the Sergeant Major came down with the instructions it was all over. And that if we saw anybody looting or anything like that, we had to shoot them. So we dismantled the gun, and I don't know if they know Vickers machine gun. It carries what they call a lock. It's a rectangular chamber. It fits on the end of a divot, and it carries lifts the bullets from the belt, puts them into the firing position, shoots, and at the same time puts another one in. It's the main mechanism of the machine gun, where the firing pin is. So what we did, we undid that, and we threw that in the jungle as far as we could throw it, and then just left the gun where it was. Our instructions were to take all the machine guns, all guns and ammunition, and take them back to the schoolhouse. But we wasn't having any. So what we did was, we did that. And then we got the grenades, opened the box of ammunition, belted ammunition, that is. Took the pin out of the grenade, but held the clasp down. And then put a box of ammunition on top of the clasp. So as soon as somebody lifted the clasp, the box of ammunition, the grenade would ignite. And it would blow, probably send the bullets up as well. So we did that in four different places around the monsoon drain. I mean, as far as we were concerned, it was going to be Japanese that would be lifting those things. And we'd be killing them with booby traps. So I heard afterwards that several of the lads had done the same. Then we got our revolvers and belted them up against the wall so it bent the barrel a bit and slung them in the jungle. And we then started on our way back to the schoolhouse. But halfway down they stopped us and told us we had to go to the pineapple factory, which is just off Geylang. It's in Geylang, but just off the Kallang Bridge, near the airport, running alongside the then Singapore airport. And it was one whacking great building full of cases of pineapple chunks. Case upon case upon case. And it was then about 9 or 10 o'clock at night. We was weary. We was war weary. We was tired. We was hungry. So one or two of the lads took the top off these cases, put a bayonet in and started drinking the juice. And Major Stewart came in. He was a man that... he was an old major, he was an old soldier, but he was never highly thought of. And he played out. But as far as he was concerned, that was thieving, and we shouldn't do it. It was against the law. And he put it back. He was a man, Major Stewart, that was, to give you a typical example of the old 1418 warrior type, just before the pack-in, the Japanese were coming down, and he'd got a team of... He belonged to D Company, actually. He got a team of 14 men in a monsoon rain, and they were held down, they were pinned down by the Japs. And he said, as soon as I blow my whistle, I want every man to fix bayonets and then out of the monsoon drain and charge into that jungle, which was an expanse of, a main road across, possibly another 15, 20 yards of clear land, and then the jungle, where the Japs were lined up shooting at him. And he gave the order, fix bayonets, get ready. And he blew his whistle, and they shouted, charge, charge him like a rugby team. So the lads run into the jungle. And he was screaming, charge him like a rugby team, give him hell. But he forgot, he was still in the bloody drain. He lived. They didn't. They died. 14 men there was expendable. And they just bloody died because a stupid man shouted, charge him like a rugby team. 14 men against the Japanese army. That was a mentality of, the type of officer we had. We, as parade ground soldiers, as disciplinarians, we had the best officers in the world. But as men who could think and fight, no chance. There was only one or two that was any good. King Clark wasn't with us then, he'd gone back. We had a Lieutenant John Gunning. He wasn't so bad, but not all that clever.
How did Stewart spell his name? Can you remember?
Major Stewart, Stewart. It was a shame for him. His batman raped his wife in Egypt. She was coming out of the bathroom one day. She'd been having a bath. And she came out and she must have been planting herself. And the batman raped her. He got 6 months. They called him Horsey because he was mad on bloody horses. Everywhere he went, he had to be riding a horse. Even if it were in the main street. he's that type of man. We had some good officers. Captain Buchan. Major Cooper. There's another guy, another officer, Lieutenant Dewar. You know Dewar's whiskey?
Yeah.